Welcome to WisePod. Andalusia Farm, the home of Flannery O'Connor, is pleased to connect you with all manner of business happening here. As Flannery said, you can get to Milledgeville by bus and buzzard. And now, via WisePod. Enjoy.
I'm pleased to introduce today our wonderful speaker from New Orleans. Catherine Kroetzer-Laborde. She's an associate professor of English at Xavier University in New Orleans, and attended graduate and undergraduate school at the University of New Orleans. She's a writer and a teacher, and we're delighted that she was able to come all that way to share with us today what it's like to teach Flannery O'Connor at a historically black college. Mm-hmm. So she'll be speaking on Hazel Mote's Is Not Black. And then we'll be reading some from her own writing about her visit to Andalusia. So please join me in welcoming Catherine.
And, thank you. Oh, you'll have to forgive me because I'm just, as you know, my witness in the back there knows, I'm just getting over a cold. A cold that did not keep me from celebrating Mardi Gras. Nothing stops that, but still getting over that. I'm going to start actually with the quote lighter piece that appears here, and we have these in the back for sale if anybody's interested, along with something that's a little bit more historic, a copy of Xavier University Studies from 1963, where a writer is writing about Flannery O'Connor while she's still alive, which I think is really interesting. It's up front if you're interested. Yours are free. You get some for the program. Beads and books. There you go. Beads and books. But I'm going to be reading from this first, and I haven't read this since I wrote it. It's called Morning Flannery. Morning as in sad, not good morning. And it's basically about a visit I made to Andalusia and to Milledgeville back in August of 2011. I was doing some field work for a course I was developing with a colleague in theology called The Theology of Flannery O'Connor. And I said, you know, it'd be a great idea if I came to Andalusia so I could see what it was really like. And of course, I just wanted to come here. But the visit ended up affecting me quite suddenly in a way I didn't expect. So that's what this is about. Milledgeville, Georgia, Thursday afternoon. I was sitting on a leather couch in Blackbird Coffee. It had only been a few months before that I had applied for a grant from my university in order to prepare a new course about Flannery O'Connor. The course being an interdisciplinary one, I was not alone in my pursuit of money to guarantee the pursuit of knowledge, and when that grant was awarded to my colleague, a theology professor, he purchased books that considered her fiction as it related to religion. Already having a shelf full of books on O'Connor myself, I proposed to take a short trip to Milledgeville, Georgia, the writer's hometown, in order to do a little field work. More specifically, I planned a trip to Andalusia, the 544-acre farm where she lived with her mother, the widow Regina Klein O'Connor, during the last 14 years of her life. By May, I had the four-day trip all mapped out. I was to leave early on the first Tuesday of August and arrive in Atlanta with plenty of time to rent a car and drive to Milledgeville. I had made reservations at the new Fairfield Inn that was located almost right across the highway from the property's entrance. In doing my homework, I saw that there would be points of interest for those not interested in O'Connor. While currently the county seat of Baldwin, the town had been, and I know I'm preaching to the choir here, y'all know this, had been the capital of Georgia from 1804 to 1868, losing its prestigious position during Reconstruction. For many years, this move cast Milledgeville as a representation of the Old South, as commerce and attention were shifted to Atlanta. If that had not been enough of a blow, the town was associated with the state's first public mental hospital that was, at one time, one of the country's largest as well, housing as many as 13,000 patients. In the days before mental illness was recognized as a disease, bad children throughout the South were threatened with being sent to Milledgeville as punishment. My sights, however, were set on a more particular, if not peculiar, history, and so had set up appointments with the then manager of Andalusia and the then director of Georgia College State University's O'Connor Collection. I'm sorry, of Andalusia itself, and the current director of the collection. One morning had been earmarked for a walk past the Klein family home, located near the old governor's mansion. Finally, being that the trip would coincide with the 47th anniversary of her death, I made time for a visit to her gravesite at Memory Hill Cemetery. Much of my whirlwind tour of all things Flannery was behind me by the time I walked through the glass doors of the coffee shop. Downtown Milledgeville was ripe with pedestrians that afternoon, and the street was heavy with traffic and bleary with heat. Blackbird Coffee offered a welcome respite from the sun-bright sidewalks. The back of the shop itself was cool and bar dark, save for the bright gleam of August light that poured through the large plate glass windows up front. I had the couch to myself. At one hip was a sloppy pile of thick books about O'Connor's life, about O'Connor's Georgia, and the like, and a notebook filled with the this and that of my findings. In my lap was a leather-bound travel diary. I was sipping a nice mocha, filling pages quickly and quietly and gently, crying. Why, I wrote, do we know so little about Flannery's last days? I do know, even as I ask this, that Regina would have wanted to maintain her privacy. This is how it was back in the day. One didn't put her business out there for all to see, but still, I wonder. Did Regina ever spend the night at the hospital those last few weeks? Did she go back and forth to Andalusia, or did she stay at the nearby Klein home? Was she there the moment she died? Did she cradle her daughter's lupus-ravaged frame one last time? Did Flannery, in death, become once more the girl Regina remembered? I paused, took a sip, wiped away tears. I could not tell you why this feeling of grief had suddenly and so hard hit me, but it had, and there I was in a coffee shop alone, mourning Flannery, mourning her death. Or perhaps it was I was grieving for what she had not experienced in her 39 years and what she had. In learning more about her life over that brief sliver of time, I was realizing what I did not know about her painfully real suffering, about her very human existence and passing. I felt inconsolable as I imagined Flannery's last days spent in a hospital, dying from the bite of the same red wolf that had killed her own father. Dying, and perhaps reliving the death she had witnessed at 15. Dying and working to finish a short story collection, knowing she would not be around for its publication. I looked around for a diversion. From where I sat, the light-blasted windows up front appeared almost as an opening to a cave. The room felt almost as empty. A young woman sat on the couch across from me, the light from her computer screen illuminating her face. She raised her coffee cup to her mouth, took one quick sip, and then another. When the final days for Flannery happened, when they came, I continued in my diary, was she denied the blessing that is coffee? She died of renal failure. In the end, was she allowed to drink at all? Could she raise a cup to her own lips? Did she sip through a straw? Was she covered with a lupus rash? Had she lost all her hair? Was she in a hospital gown? Was she in something soft and familiar from home? Did she rail against death or cry, or did she simply lie there until her life evaporated? Pausing for a second or two, I was startled by a question spoken suddenly in my direction. Excuse me, but is the college still a girls' school? This woman was blonde and flawlessly coiffed and dressed in a deep pink suit. She was sitting at another couch. She had a thick southern accent and a rope of pearls that dipped into a freckled cleavage. I wiped the tears away from my cheeks. She repeated her question. She was likely not much older than me, but she seemed worlds more grown up. Gold glittered from her manicured fingers and tennis-tanned wrist. She reached for her cappuccino, nodding as I explained that I was not with GCSU, but knew for a fact that men now attend the school that had once been known alternately as Georgia State College for Women and Women's College of Georgia. I had seen myself, male students, the day before as I'd walked around the campus, wondering about how differently this stately red brick campus seemed from my own university, the university I call home. My decidedly urban university is so close to the interstate that the students are serenaded by traffic. The main grounds are separated from the west campus by a canal, and to reach the southern campus, one walks through a neighborhood some dorm dwellers call the hood. The blonde woman. It's true. The blonde woman turned to the young woman sitting on the red couch across from me. She asked if the college is co-ed. Co-ed? I winced at the term. The blonde leaned forward, adjusted her skirt as she did, and said that her daughter attends a women's college. They recently had a vote to see if they should let men in, she said, and they all decided no. The young woman nodded as she did, and she took a loose lock of hair that fell forward. Her hair was wet, and the longer pieces hugged her neck and shoulders. She combed her fingers through her hair, and then gathered that hair up and away from her neck, and twisted it into a rope of sorts, which she quickly released. I looked past her to the windows where a flatbed logging truck carrying pine trees, stripped of their green, rumbled ever so slowly, the way everything happens so slowly on an early August late afternoon in the middle of Flannery's, Georgia. I could have made my trip to Milledgeville at almost any point that summer, I suppose, but in truth, I knew I wanted it to coincide with the anniversary of her death. My devotion to O'Connor had begun in the mid-70s, not long after the time that Alice Walker and her mother made the now famous trek to Andalusia. The story I read had been just another American literature assignment in an honors English class, but I came away from reading A Good Man is Hard to Find, moved, changed, and believing that I was Flannery O'Connor reincarnated. A funny reckoning made all the more humorous when one considers that her complete commitment to staunch pre-Vatican II brand of Catholicism would have totally prohibited her from agreeing to this idea. In the short seconds that followed finishing the reading of her story, in that little bit of time spent flipping the pages to the back of the book to read about the incredible author with the funny name, one fact was obvious. I, sad to say, could not be her reincarnation, as I had been a prissy 2-year-old when she died. But that hopeful delusion was immediately replaced by an even more ambitious and confident conviction, and it was that I, too, was a writer. It was an odd conclusion to reach, I know, but I was convinced, or maybe I should say converted, suddenly, no logic needed, no more proof required beyond an overwhelming admiration for O'Connor's writing and my own faith in the scrapbook full of Literary Fair prize ribbons at my house. Yes, I had started the trip to Milledgeville on a Tuesday morning, about a month or so before I was to turn 50, but in many ways, this journey had begun when I was a 14-year-old wearing peppermint-flavored kissing gloss. Flannery O'Connor was not so much a favorite author I wanted to visit, but a personal patron saint of prose I needed to thank. Knowing I was there on the anniversary of her death, I fully expected to find some kind of something going on. A potted red geranium placed by her grave, perhaps, or a gathering of devotees reading from her letters. I drove through the cemetery gates and passed a team of prison workers cleaning the grounds. That gave me a sense of anticipation. It is ironic, then, that the one person I met there that Wednesday morning was a woman who did not think much of O'Connor's work at all. She was elderly, walking her Yorkie on the grounds before the heat of the day grew too intense, and her accent and voice recalled the pinched timbre of an O'Connor character. But while she didn't think much of books and stories, quote, only a Yankee would like them, Miss Jane did know exactly where Milledgeville's most famous daughter was buried, and she said she would lead me right to her. Though she did not say as much, I could tell she wondered why someone would cross a handful of states to visit the grave of a writer who wrote in a way that Miss Jane and other people from Milledgeville's old guard admitted to not liking or not even fully understanding. "I'm among some of the people who did not understand what she was writing," she said. "A lot of us compared it to Uncle Tom's Cabin." And though she did not point out a single headstone other than the one I was there to see, or mention that the cemetery was listed on the National Register of Historic Places, I could sense her wondering why someone would go to so much trouble to walk the grounds and not take it all in, the graves of Southern statesmen and Confederate soldiers, slaves and mental hospital patients, a spiritualist and a stagecoach robber, and the University of Georgia's first football coach, all there. Why only see the gravestone of such a writer as O'Connor? "It's a lot of us in town who feel it's only the Yankees who appreciate her books," she said. "I never read it, but the Yankees loved it." "Well, you know, let's face it," I said, or rather she said, "let's face it, it wasn't Gone with the Wind." And that was a comment O'Connor herself had heard more than once in her lifetime. Milledgeville had been the antebellum capital of Georgia after all. The cemetery has great patches of shade here and there, resplendent with cedars and magnolias, pines and oaks. But the flat marble graves of O'Connor and the six others of the O'Connor-Tarleton plot lay in the full face of the sun. They were close to a chain-link fence that separated the cemetery from the street below. Cars zipped down West Franklin. An artificial poinsettia plant sat on the foot of her father's grave, but there were no flowers for Flannery. There were, however, 11 pennies that dribbled down the length of the cross that was engraved on the stone. Reaching into my purse for a penny, I added a 12th to the others. Sunlight glinted off the copper rather painfully. I had reached the sweet chocolate-laced bottom of my drink, but resisted the urge to slurp it through my straw. The coffee shop, near empty when I had entered, had suddenly filled and was loud with chatting. To the right, a girl talked to the barista, who in turn talked to two boys. Another girl sat at a table, texting. A young man with a curly crown of hair rested his chin in his hand as he drank espresso nonchalantly and had a book open before him. "My other daughter is in the military," the blonde continued. "She has already done one tour of Iraq." The younger woman said that her husband was stationed in Japan. "I'm going over there," she said. "As soon as I graduate, I'm going." She was 25. She was almost finished with school. The diamond heart that slid along a golden chain winked from the hollow of her throat. "I'm going to teach," she said. "Well, it will be nice to be together again, won't it? And in Japan, of all places," I said. "You must really, really miss him." And then the blonde straightened suddenly. "Well, the town is so pretty," she said. "We came in here just to avoid Atlanta." Okay. Atlanta is a 2-hour drive away from Milledgeville and one trip that I would be making myself the next day on my way back home. But I didn't add this to the last embers of a weird conversation. Instead, I nodded in agreement to the prettiness of Milledgeville and let my gaze drift to yet another flatbed truck toting a bundle of naked logs. I had spent that morning at Andalusia taking a tour with the site manager and the director of O'Connor Studies, and for part of the time with the director of the Andalusia Foundation. I was given the official tour, but because I was there as a scholar of sorts, and because I was the only visitor at that point, and because the mood seemed easy and relaxed, I was given a little extra attention here and there. The tour was redirected at times by my questions and peppered with laughter and wonderful insight. It was in a light moment during the tour that the manager, Mark, removed boxes that blocked a white door. Everyone laughed, and I was jokingly asked how much reality I could take. We were in Regina's bedroom, a room not decorated and really not part of the tour, since it was more or less a gathering place for boxes and other items. I had wanted to know if that door led to a closet or to the backyard, but in truth, it led to the small bathroom that Regina and Flannery had shared. Mark cracked open the door and mentioned that the overhead light did not work, so the little room remained dark. From where I stood, all I could see was the side of the toilet tank and seat. I would be lying if I were to say that I didn't get a small, perverse thrill seeing such a personal room, particularly since it was not part of the standard tour. If nothing else, this glimpse told me that Mark respected my sincere efforts to not simply pay homage to the literary idol, but rather to try to absorb as much of O'Connor's world as I possibly could. But the brief look at the old and rusting toilet brought to mind the idea of Flannery grabbing her crutches and making her way down the hallway in the middle of the night. I wondered if Regina slept through such actions, or if she woke with the slightest sound, no matter how ordinary. I wondered if she worried over her daughter at such moments, or if she would simply turn over, fluff her pillow, and try to fall back to sleep before morning crept past the homemade curtains, calling her to the monumental tasks of both caring for an ill daughter and running a dairy farm. I was shown the front parlor, and the newer back parlor, and the kitchen. I saw a silver martini set placed on top of the Hot Point refrigerator that was purchased after the sale of a short story to General Electric Playhouse. I saw the formal dining living room, a space made more memorable by a heavy wooden buffet featuring a carving of a pig carcass being drained of its blood. I went upstairs and I saw the bedrooms Flannery could not access. And I saw Flannery's room with its single bed and its high-backed wooden chair and a wooden desk and a typewriter. And I saw crutches leaning against the bookcase. Flannery's room was cordoned off and arranged in such a way as to suggest how she had worked. Regina's room was not set up for show, but it was in that room that I spied two photographs I'd never seen before. Both were in that room, and both were casually placed among the jumble of storage overflow. One was a portrait of an obviously ill Flannery, face stern, eyes peering through heavy glasses, hair thin but parted and arranged, her hand gripping the roll handle of the typewriter as she adjusts a sheet of paper. The dress is smart and the necklace stylish, but she is swallowed by both. The sun coming through the side window is unkind, for it shows that, although she is not yet 40, she has the face of an old woman, with lupus having stolen her youth. That youth was evident in the second photograph. The Flannery of this photo could be no older than 14, back when she was still known to all as Mary Flannery. Her face is free of cumbersome spectacles. The print of her dress is floral. Her eyes are wide apart and wide open, and her lips are parted not in a smile, but in an expression that comes across as one of discovery. I wonder if Regina had ever thought of her daughter, really as two daughters, the adult Flannery, who had existed before the diagnosis, who had gone to college and then to the writer's workshop in Iowa, who had signed a book contract, who had moved to New York and then to Connecticut, who was just beginning to taste success. And the Flannery who had come home one Christmas for a visit and never left, who had to learn from a friend that the diagnosis pointed to lupus, the Flannery who forever after walked through Andalusia on crutches, who could not use the stairs nor take the brick steps to enter her home from the front door, the Flannery who grew thinner and paler, who wrote every morning and then either entertained or rested or responded to letters every afternoon, always too sick to help out around the house. The Flannery who, time and time again, wrote stories of farms run by domineering mothers whose impatient adult children lived at home. And once wrote that, in her family, the only acceptable emotion to show was that of irritation. Perhaps, had Regina been asked, she would have said there had been a third Flannery, or rather, the original, one that had been a quirky only child whose father had been snatched away by lupus at the age of 45. It would have been that Flannery, that fresh-faced Mary Flannery, who would have known Andalusia well, though not as home, for by that point she lived in the Klein mansion. At that time she would have known it as Sorrel Farm, the land owned and tended to by her uncle. Sorrel Farm was a great place to escape the reality of life without father. But it was so much more than that. For it was on those green and rolling acres that the girl Mary Flannery would ride horses in the long days of lost summers, hidden from the world by a black line of trees, that the author, Flannery O'Connor, would write of later. And I would see myself that last night in Milledgeville, standing there in the hotel parking lot, leaning against my rental car, listening to the metallic rasp of 13-year cicadas, and breathing in the piney night air. Thank you. When I came here on that trip, Dr. Gentry asked me if I had ever considered writing about what it is to teach at an HBU, or an HBCU, stands for Historically Black University or College and University. And honestly, you know, I was full of ideas about what it was like to teach at such a place. And again, teaching Flannery O'Connor, because with the constant reference to the word nigger in many of the stories. And the racism that's obviously present in these stories makes it interesting to teach these stories to mostly black students at the university where I teach. I believe it's like 71% black, okay? It's also a Catholic university. Okay, and I believe only 26% or so of the student body now are actually Catholic. Most of them, I believe, are Christian. Most of them are Protestant. Okay, so when my colleague teaches about the theology of Flannery O'Connor, he often starts off with explaining what the difference is between Catholicism and Protestantism. Because me being Catholic, I'm like, well, of course it's a ritual. Everything's a ritual, you know, whereas the Protestants, it's a different mindset altogether. In considering that, you know, I've been putting off for years writing this essay, and I just finished it this morning, I have to tell you. and here's my proof, okay? Here's my proof. And I will tell you, it actually made me nervous, so that Michael is with me. Michael's an editor and a writer, and I read the last section to him before, because it actually, it's sometimes, it's nerve-wracking to write about race. You know, and the effects and teaching, all that sort of thing. So I will say that this is no harder for me to write than any other essay, because you always drag your feet and such. But I'm so glad you dropped the idea in my head. Thank you so much for that. Because I really thought, before I left town, I thought I had two sections written, and I thought the third section was going to go an entirely different way than it did. And this is called Hazel Motes Is Not Black. In the information I gave Elizabeth originally, I said it would be looking at this with humor. I guess there is some humor to this. There's a lot less than I thought would be there originally. So anyway, so it's funny here and there, I guess. Years ago, I had the luxury of having an office just outside a large and funky room we call the English Major's Lounge. Those days are gone. The third floor was deemed unsafe by the fire marshal standards, and so we moved. But back in the days when my office was there, I would hold small classes in that land of mismatched chairs, flea market paintings, a covered couch, and a large packing trunk that had come to the university decades, and I do mean decades before, when one Sister Mary Akeen McKinney, presumably a sister of the Blessed Sacrament, made her way from, of all places, Macon, Georgia, to New Orleans to teach at the Lone University established by the order's founder, St. Catherine Drexel. We used that trunk as a coffee table. I placed copies of the student literary journal on top. The room itself had been long avoided by many because of tales of voices, of murmurings, of suddenly slammed doors, of a suicide that had taken place up there decades, and I do mean decades before, with a nun hanging herself from a chandelier that no longer exists thanks to the drop ceilings, and drops of blood on a floor long covered by a really ugly carpet. American Horror Story, you ain't got nothing on us. So it was easy to claim that space, that haunted space, and fill it with this and that, and make it a clubhouse of sorts. My students enjoyed the relaxed atmosphere that I made use of to employ a kind of book club setting, hoping that this more casual setting would encourage conversation about literature. I used the book club approach in teaching freshmen and senior English majors alike. How I miss that room. For one thing, I could sit in my office as the lounge slowly filled with class members. In those days, I used not so much a clock to indicate when it was time to emerge, but the sounds of their voices. I can't say that I really listened to what they said, but just how many voices I was hearing at once. And on that one particular morning, though, it was a Thursday morning, I did hear something. I did hear some words that broke through my own thoughts and stopped my grading pen mid-stroke. And those words were, "Is Hazel Moats black?" One student was asking the other. I heard the beginnings of conversation on the subject. I immediately stepped outside my office and leaned against the painted door frame. I told the three students that that was a great question, and I asked them to bring it up in class. And 1 hour later, they did. And I have to admit that that was not the first time I had heard this kind of question posed about a character from a work of a mid-century Southerner. I don't think it's a question that comes up often at those places we now call PWIs, private white institutes, but in HBU like Xavier University, and it's here that I'd like to point out that being a historically black university is a congressional designation. This sort of question is, well, not that unusual, I suppose, as is any question that considers race. The year before, I had been asked in that very room if Miss Amelia of Carson McCullers' Ballad of the Sad Cafe was African American. "What makes you think she's African American?" I countered. They used the text itself to answer. "She was a dark, tall woman." They went on. "She's self-made. She's self-reliant. Sorry, she ate fried chicken and collard greens. She made medicine and could doctor folk. She could beat up a man if she had to." These were their observations. It was then that I pointed out the unspoken rule of literature written by white, that literature written by white people, or at least white people of that time, and that was that a person who was of color would be specifically said to be of color, and that dark meant either olive-skinned or the word was being used metaphorically. There was in Carson McCullers' work, quote, "the old Negro who cooked for Miss Amelia," he's black. And there was also, quote, "the Negro who was on his way to make love," he was black. Yes, the term Negroes was used back then. Colored people was used. African Americans would not be on the scene for a good 40 years. Now you might ask why these students, and they're all about 18 years old in this particular class, assume that Hazel Moats is black. Is it because he too is described as poor? Yes, that's one reason. It's because his suit, they said, and I'm quoting here, was glaring blue and the price tag was still stapled on the sleeve. The latter detail being a fashion thing, my students saw trending a few years back when people were wearing the price tags. So they thought, okay, this guy's doing it. Is it because he's wearing a hat? Now, something I know that was common among the mid-century years, but only something they see among the really cool. That his eyes are described as being the color of pecan shells seems to them just another descriptive way of saying brown. And again, such food-related phrases employed to describe the shade of a black person's skin is common to them. They read that sort of thing all the time. Finally, they said, he's a preacher of sorts. He's a preacher. And he's poor. And that's what made them wonder, is Hazel Motes black? Now, I have taught Wise Blood to freshmen in a comp and lit class, so that's all kinds of majors, mostly science majors, and seniors in an American lit seminar. I have also more recently taught the novel in an interdisciplinary course I dreamed up called The Theology of Flannery O'Connor. My teaching partner and co-creator of the course, too, has heard this question and the reasons why they think Hayes should be black. He will say, my teaching partner, black people don't own poor. I've heard him say, as he goes on about this, to describe how his own family members back in the day took on boarders in the house to keep food on the table. I go on to tell them that the details they pick up on would have sent a different message to her contemporary readers. The glaring blue suit would be read as the choice of a person who did not have many choices. And the price tag on the suit would suggest a lack of caring on the part of Motes. He is likely, I tell them, suffering from what used to be called shell shock, but is now known as PTSD, and that O'Connor likely observed firsthand this kind of behavior in the young men she knew as students in the Iowa MFA program. There is the porter Motes sees in the first moments of the novel, the one who is described as, Motes recognizing as, quote, a param nigger from Easterod. Now, this is not the observation of a black man speaking casually of another black man, I tell them, but of a white man whose face turns, quote, an ugly red just a few pages later. Again, I tell these students the rule. A person described in a work of literature written at that time is assumed to be white unless otherwise stated. That those who are people of color are labeled as others, as other things in the parlance of the day. They are called color, they are called Negro. And unfortunately, and particularly in the case of Flannery O'Connor's work, they are called nigger over and over again. This is something I warn students about on the first day of class and on the second. In almost every story I tell them, you will run across not only that word, but attitudes that were prevalent in the South at the time. But the stories are not about race. They're about other things. Though race is very much a part of these stories, and because race was very much a part of life in the South then, and in many ways now. One reason my students have assumed that Motes is black is because he's pulled over by the police simply for being different. I have to admit that I often do not know which story belongs in which collection. I forget which one's where. I attribute this to the fact that I read them out of order. In teaching them, I do not present them in chronological order, but rather in accordance to whatever my plan is that semester, what sort of message I'm trying to teach, what my teaching idea is. This semester, the one that's happening right now, in teaching the theology of Flannery O'Connor, my colleague and I chose to start with Revelation so that the students would make more sense of the lectures on the grotesque and Southern social order from the beginning. We followed that with the artificial nigger so that they could apply recently learned theology knowledge. I tried to read my personally annotated copy of her works before teaching these classes just to refresh myself, but I have to admit, in starting with these two particular stories, I am less focused on my blue and black scribbles than I am on the racism of Ruby Turpin and Mr. Head, with each repeat of that which I refuse to call the N-word, I flinch inwardly, and I wonder, do my students do the same? I address this topic in their first assigned reflection of the semester. Elena writes, quote, "Hearing the word nigger causes conflicting emotions. Upon hearing it, I don't have any initial anger, even though I do understand why others do. There is such pain and history behind the word, as it was used as a slur and insult to an entire race of people. Yet, I do not experience any chill bumps or energy surge when I hear it. On one hand, this could mean that I'm so far removed from it and so desensitized to it that it has no effect. On the other hand, since it is being used in this context, I understand that it is written in the vernacular of a period when such terms were very much a normal occurrence. This causes conflict for me because I do not necessarily want to be desensitized to it. I don't want to forget what the word represented. I don't want to forget that many have fought and died to abolish the injustices that came along with the term. However, I see no need to hold a grudge or have my mind plagued by issues that are in the past and cannot be changed, ones that are part of my history. Chanel, another student, commented on how the word has been taken back by many black people and adapted into a term of endearment, attesting to blacks, as she says, ability to recreate beauty out of the ugly. Though adds also that in seeing a page punctuated by the word nigger every few lines, she understands more fully how this word was used to degrade and reduce black people as a whole. Every few lines. I started to write a comment on her paper about exaggeration, and then I stopped. The frequency stings me too, but how often is the word used? As it turns out, the word nigger is used in The Artificial Nigger a total of 21 times, and that includes the title. In Revelation, it's used 24 times. Of the short stories, and I should say right here, I did not delve into the novels or the letters. The top offenders are The Displaced Person and Judgment Day, with both scoring 31 slurs. But these are the exception, it seems, and not the rule. In her first collection, five stories have zero occurrence of the word, and four occurrences are spread out among three stories. In all, the word is seen 56 times in the collection A Good Man is Hard to Find, with 52 of those occurrences happening in two stories. In Everything That Rises Must Converge, which of course was published after her death, the word is seen 63 times. As is true with the first collection, the offensive word is pretty much limited to two stories, with Greenleaf coming in a very, very, very distant third place with five. The word does not occur at all in three stories, and only once in A View of the Woods, and The Lame Shall Enter First, and in her last story, Parker's Back, once in each one of those stories. I grew more curious about her master's thesis. In total, the word appears 70 times, and there are only six stories, as opposed to Good Man's 10 and Rises 9. Of these stories, well, of all her stories, the one to use the word the most often is the story that leads her thesis collection, The Geranium, with a whopping 42 mentions. It's interesting to note that by the time she had revised the story into what appears as Judgment Day, she had lost 11 slurs. But there was more in the recurrent usage department to take note of. Having grown up in the South in the way that only a granddaughter of a Virginian can, I know that the worst name a white person can be called is trash. And there was plenty of trash talk in O'Connor. In looking at Flannery O'Connor, the complete stories, that's all the short stories right there, I found three incidents of trashy, four uses of trash, including French trash, but excluding references to actual rubbish, white trashy, and please note the hyphen there, white trashy, was used four times, and the grand trailer park queen of all, white hyphen trash, was used 17 times. The word cracker was used eight times, but each time that she was talking about the snack, and it was usually served on a plate. Knowing that O'Connor's had a passion for theology, I looked for other words, and there are in her short stories, and yes, I do include here, You Can't Be Any Poorer Than Dead, The Partridge Festival, Why Do the Heathen Rage, The Peeler, Heart of the Park, and Enoch and the Gorilla. There are 166 references to God, eight references to God, Jesus is mentioned over 100 times, but only a third of those are of the exclamatory variety. There are other words I know she used often in her writing. Revelation, I'm convinced, is one. Son is another. Like a good preacher, Flannery understood how repetition could make a point. What is it like to teach Flannery O'Connor at an HBU? Since I've never taught her work anywhere else, I don't know that teaching these stories to mostly African-American students is really any different than teaching them to students of another hue. To all students nowadays, the pieces are, quote, old, and it's obvious that they are set not only in the time of civil rights turmoil, but written in the pre-politically correct era. But what is also obvious to them is how much what they read of no longer exists. A big part of the way I currently teach O'Connor is to hand out lists of objects and expressions they will encounter in a story to encourage them to look these up. I don't want to waste my class time explaining green stamps, iron lungs, and the like. It is true, though, that there have been moments in teaching my students that have opened my eyes. I have witnessed a student or two, always female, becoming enraged by the image, and this would come from the artificial nigger, of the, quote, large colored woman leaning in a doorway in the middle of Atlanta in the middle of the day. These students feel she is being objectified as a black woman. Now, I explained that in the mid-1950s, a round woman was considered ideal, no matter what her color, and that a thin and sickly Flannery was likely more aware of that than anyone. This explanation goes nowhere, as does pointing out that the boy, fixated on the woman's bosom, is a child starving for a mother's affection when he wants her to, quote, reach down and pick him up and draw him against her. Still, they see the sexual stereotype. When reading the story, The River, I have seen a room full of students stumble and gasp over the words, a man wearing a white sheet. The next sentence clearly goes on to describe Saint Joseph, halo and all. Before that heart-stopping second, they see a Klansman. Oddly enough, in a class where I teach stories like The Enduring Chill, The Displaced Person, and Revelation, and that is to say stories that feature black farm workers, at least one student will refer in a quiz or a paper at the beginning of the semester to these characters as the slaves. The first time this happened, and it's happened a few times, I blamed myself for not pointing out more clearly the story's time period. After all, it could be easy to get lost in a rural story that mentions objects that no longer exist here and there. But my stating, hey guys, these are the 1950s, not the, 1850s, has not made that first quiz or paper reference to slaves go away. Whether it's just or whether it's right or whether it's wrong to think this way, I have to tell you, my first reaction has always been, how could black students not be aware when slavery ended? But it finally occurred to me, and with a slap, that this is because these students, who are always like the smarter ones in the class, I have to admit, they're not dummies, okay? Recognize that while slavery itself ended, the slave owner attitude did not automatically die with it. It sauntered on from generation to generation, and they recognize it. When they read the thoughts of Asbury's mother or of Mrs. McIntyre, they are reading the thoughts that were passed down from the slave owners to the next generations. When they read the thoughts of Mrs. Shortley or Mr. Head, they see into the heads, into the thoughts, the very thoughts passed down from the poor whites who scrambled to make a living, who clung to the idea that even as they sweated in the fields, At least they weren't slaves. The Emancipation Proclamation may have handed these new and black Americans the keys to their freedom, but it could not squash attitudes and assumptions that had been years in the making, and it would take decades upon decades to eliminate. Which, in a way, leads me back to Hazel Motes and why some of my students wonder, is he black? We are taught by our experiences, and even though education and empathy teach us to consider the world through the lens of another, our first knee-jerk reaction comes from our own point of view. Many of my students know what it is to be the other. They write essays about being followed in stores with a stream of, "Can I help you? Can I help you?" following them. They write of being pulled aside for driving while black. One student recently told me of being reported over and over again by a neighbor, an elderly and nervous woman, for sitting outside in her own car in front of her own townhouse apartment. Even as things seem to be getting better, there are stories in the news to remind us that we are not quite there yet. Still not in the place O'Connor saw as ideal, as she wrote in The Enduring Chill, of one of those moments of communion when the difference between black and white is dissolved into nothing. Before I started teaching at Xavier University of Louisiana, I thought it was enough to simply be not prejudiced. I have learned along the way to recognize, however, that I come from a position of privilege. I really, really believe that it's something that Flannery O'Connor herself recognized about herself. She recognized this as she revealed how many white people of that time, of that place, thought of black people. And it is that those secret thoughts, they're lazy, they steal, they lie, that are far more wince-producing as I stand before my students than any oft-repeated six-letter word.
Thank you, Catherine. We can take a few questions, but there's a reception awaiting, folks, some refreshments in the dining room, mm-hmm. and we can continue the conversation there. But happy to entertain a few questions here if folks have any.
Should I tell my story now, my funny story?
Sure.
I'll tell my funny story now. It's a funny story, right? The one I told you the other day? Yeah. You laughed. Okay. Josephine Humphrey was talking about a time when Robert Penn Warren was going to speak at some sort of thing, and he was in the car, I think with Josephine Humphrey, and with a student. And he said, you know, there's always that awkward moment, oh, there's questions, and then, you know, what if no one raises his hand? So, student, I'm going to give you a question to ask me so that little embarrassing moment doesn't happen. So the student said, okay. And so Robert Penn Warren phrased this incredible multi-layered question. And the student repeated it and repeated it until he had it just right. And so the thing happened. The moment came. Are there any questions? And the student stood right up, raised his hand. He said, I have a question. Said, go ahead. Said it perfectly. And Robert Penn Warren looked at him and said, that is the most idiotic question I've ever heard in my life. Totally set up. Isn't that a great story? I wish I had witnessed that.
I'm glad we didn't do that.
Yeah, I'm glad he didn't do that. So, yeah. So, anyway.
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
As a writer, I'm always curious about people's writing patterns or how they organize their time. You know, Flannery wrote every day. She was very disciplined about it and spoke about the discovery of that, the need for discipline. And I imagine there was some urgency for her to create her art, having a diagnosis, a lethal, a disease that killed her father. She lived for 12 years, he lived for 4, lupus. So I'm curious if, I always like to ask writers what their writing discipline is or what their thoughts are about facing that blank sheet of paper or screen.
Yeah. Not to sound mean about this, but Flannery O'Connor also got out of doing a lot of chores. She didn't have kids. She didn't have a husband. She didn't, you know, there were lots of things. She could just have a lot of me time. She could have a lot of me time. So, and she had a mother who, even though she didn't quite get her work, really knew how important those mornings were and really guarded that for Flannery. You know, so Flannery didn't have to, you know, answer the phone, or if someone came and said, I want to speak to Flannery, she said, go away, make no noise, you know, that kind of thing. So, when I'm working on a project, and when I'm seriously working on a project, it's kind of like, yeah, I'm working on something, you know, whatever. I will become more disciplined. I have done things like actually use Facebook when I was working on this book about the refrigerators of post-Katrina New Orleans with how all kinds of messages. And this isn't fiction. But there were many fictions written on the refrigerators. They were amazing. I would do something like, I would just not go into what I was doing, because I think that's a little, you know, wow, I'm doing this, considering, who cares, you know, but I would just write as my, you know, as my status, chapter 5, chapter 3, chapter 7, just kind of like, I'm declaring to the world, this is what I'm doing. And those who care, I said, it's just me, my way of making sure I stay on track and do things. And the way my book was set up, the chapters did move around because they could be, you know, interchanged. So that wasn't an issue. So I used that trick. One of the big things I will do is I will just make sure I set up time to do things. And something else I did was I tried to make sure just to keep things focused for me. I will do things like put something on top, on the refrigerator, of all things. With that particular book, the publisher had told me I had to have so many words. And so I would just keep a running tally of how many words were in each chapter. And as the chapters changed, these things were all messed up. And that's okay. Mess is good. Mess means you're doing some work, right? And so I would do that. And I would know, and then I'd say, okay, you have this many words, and this is how many you need. I'm working right now on a very small book that needs to be finished by May, just because I can enter it in a contest. So I will have things set up, just again, the visual things, just to make sure I see and I'm focused, and what am I doing today, and that kind of thing. You have to scoop out time for yourself. You have to do that. And so just whatever works. You know, Michael back there was talking about using the idea of using 3x5 cards to help him get through a writing project. I think that's a great idea, just to sort of keep you focused. And so, okay, this is what needs to be addressed today. And so whatever works for you, you know. And also, I think also what's important is realizing that you might change. I used to be much more of a middle of the night writer. Not so much as I've gotten older. Now I'm more of a morning writer. I hate admitting to that, but it's true. And so you just kind of have to embrace who you once were, who you are now. And even if that now is just for a couple of months, embracing that and working with that. Does that answer your question, kind of? Okay. Yes, hi.
Hi. Do your students enjoy Flannery O'Connor, or do they look at it as, this is good for me to understand someone who's been dead for 50 years and had something to say, you know, irrespective of the racial issues, or perhaps looking at the racial issues and looking at the contrast and the lack of contrast between then and now?
I would say, like, one time I taught this twice as a seminar. And so we read all the short stories. And what got to be fun with that, we'd start off the class with someone would make a presentation on something academic, you know. And then afterwards we'd spend the second half, because it was a weekly seminar, in what we call the book club mode, you know. We'd sit around, we'd drink, you know, coffee, that kind of thing, whatever. And we wanted, I know, but it is a Catholic university, is it not? So, you know, but yeah, therefore. But we would just, We have Brian Lerner. But we would discuss things, and with them, they would start noticing, oh, well, look, this story is like this one, and this one's like this one, and this one's like this one, and I encourage that kind of casual understanding on their own. In the class I'm teaching right now with the theology teacher, basically we have it structured so there's one story a week, and on Tuesdays it's literature day, and on Thursday it's theology day. And so what we're really trying to teach them that, and it could work for other things too, but particularly in Flannery O'Connor, since she was a great writer, the literature is definitely there, even though she might say the black hat represents nothing, it's just what they wore, and it's people like me who come in, oh, the black hat represents this. We'll discuss whatever it is. One time I had the students look at nothing but eye references. And what do they think that means, that kind of thing. And just different things, whereas the theology, it's the omega points, the moment of grace, it's whatever. So they are there realizing that they're reading this and having to turn stuff in and get graded. But I'll say, was this funny? Was there anything you particularly liked? And they will bring up what's funny and such about it. So they do enjoy, but they're also very grade-minded. They all want to get into med school and such, so their grades are important. Truly, truly. Yeah, yeah.
Over your years of teaching, has it gotten easier introducing her work to you? Like with the N-word and...
Yeah. Well, you know, no. No, because from the beginning, I was really aware of how... I mean, it's offensive to me. You know, it's offensive, and we're living in politically correct times, right? So we're very sensitive, at least we should be, right, to this sort of thing. I've always started with the first or second day, so if they want to drop, we had one student, I've had two students who were very offended throughout, and we complain. I never heard the complaints, but we complain, and it's like, I told you what was in here, so get over it. You could have gotten out of the class because you knew there was offensive stuff here. I have found that it was interesting. I did the count, the word count thing, just for this. I suddenly started thinking, wow, I don't know if I've ever started with both Revelation and Artificial Nigger at once. And boy, man, it's really in your face. And I'm reading this before I go to class. I'm going, oh, I'm sorry. This is so terrible. And again, it's not so much the word as it's the attitudes. The attitudes, you know. And, you know, my mother's people way back in the day were slave owners, were plantation owners. And so those little attitudes, I mean, I grew up in a house that we never said the word nigger or anything like that. But my mother would talk about granny and things Granny would say about all kinds of things. Granny saw Lincoln in Richmond. She was a little girl. She saw and all sorts of things. And I mean, this is offensive, I know, but you'd say things like, oh, well, you know, they're like children. And it's like, ooh. But in seeing that in O'Connor, what I'm able to do is say to the students, you're going to see some very offensive things here. But the stories are not about the offensive things. That's how the people are. What is in the big picture is being said. So it's always in the beginning kind of difficult for me, just because I hate reading those thoughts, but you can't whitewash it. It's there. If you're from Fair Pond, there you go. But it was there and it's real. And they know that, and they're actually pretty good about it, to tell you the truth, you know. And I've even had some students say, well, you know, the nigger, I said, oh, please don't say that. But because they just read in the text and whatever. And these are black kids. I'm like, oh, don't do that, you know, but it will always be a little hard, and then always a little bit easier as it goes through. And I think that's actually part of the strength of her writing, I think, because she's really capturing the way people, I mean, she heard this stuff all over the place, and she's really capturing it. It's really real. Mm-hmm. Yeah, hi.
Hi. I think of New Orleans as such a multivalent place in terms mm-hmm. of race, mm-hmm. Acadian, French, Creole, and mm-hmm. all, you need more than two hands to mm-hmm. count yeah. that milieu. And I think of Milledgeville, Macon, the South, Flannery's writing as such a binary, black, white.
Mm-hmm.
How does one inform another for you?
That's interesting. In teaching at a university, only half of our students come from Louisiana, and New Orleans is not like the rest of Louisiana.
It's not like anywhere else.
It's not like anywhere else. Thank you. Thank you. We're proud of that, actually. But it's not like, and you get to the northern part of the state, and that's very different from the Cajun rest of the state, you know, so it's very, very different. So in looking at that, I never think these people are, they grew up here, they're from here, anything like that. I just sort of take it from an overall approach of being American in this country. Not all of my students have been, by the way. It's very interesting to explain this kind of stuff to students who are from Europe. Very interesting. One time I was teaching a senior seminar that actually compared Flannery O'Connor's work with the work of André Debus, who's another Southern Catholic writer. From Louisiana, but doesn't write about Louisiana too much, that kind of thing. And so that was made for a really interesting thing. And one of my students was from Czech Republic, I want to say. And it was really interesting teaching the class, the displaced person with him there, and about those Europeans and what was going on, all that sort of thing. And also having him, and at this point, I let the class do it. He did not understand. We were doing everything that rises must converge. And I was trying to explain to him to the class rather, and these are all seniors, juniors and seniors in English, about what O'Connor had said about, was it there's a curse on everybody's house or something like that. The prejudiced people are just as bad off as the overly liberal who are just trying to be liberal. I mean, that's just as bad. And so I was trying to explain what O'Connor had said about that, that everyone kind of comes off a little bad here. And he didn't quite understand that. About, well, why would that be? And so the black students, I just sat back and it was wonderful. It was like, you know, the teacherless classroom. That it was fantastic. The black students say, no, because, you know, they're just saying, well, because they're black, they're this, but that's just as bad as saying if you're black, you're that. And he just, it was very interesting to see that, so.
Thank you so much, and we can continue the conversation over some refreshments if y'all like.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.